I basically convinced them to give me a scholarship into the University of Michigan. I had to call them. I sent the videotapes. They basically sent the tight ends coach or the quarterback coach to come recruit me as a linebacker. They didn't really take it seriously. And it wasn't really until I took my visit and my mom, who I would say she was the hero in the story, walked into Lloyd Carr's office and said, you know, if you don't want to give my son a scholarship, I get it, because I can tell by virtue of the way that you recruited him, you're not really taking him seriously. Mama. Right. And Ryan, you know, my mom,
yeah.
My mom got a 1600 on the SATs. My mom wasn't someone that you would mess with, so to speak. I mean, you might try her, and then all of a sudden, all these eloquent SAT words might proliferate. She walked back out, and, you know, I had a scholarship.
This week on the Courageous Podcast, we had guest Dahani Jones, former NFL American linebacker. He played for 11 seasons. He also played football for the Michigan Wolverines, earning the All Big Ten honors for 3 straight seasons. He was selected by the New York Giants in the 6th round of the 2000 NFL Draft. That's the same year as Tom Brady. And he then dove into the entertainment arena, where he hosted Dahani Tackles the Globe and also Adventure Capitalist on CNBC. And Berman, you actually grew up with Dahani, correct?
Yeah, it's so cool to see Dahani go from the Dahani that I knew to this Dahani, where we were just kids playing up pickup in the backyard, and then all of a sudden you start rooting for this guy, and like wherever he goes, it's impossible not to root for him. He's a class act.
Yeah, he really lights up a room. We got a chance to chat before you jumped on, and he had me laughing and just easy to talk to. We talked a lot about his community and the support he got growing up, and then obviously building all his business after. So learned a lot in this one, and just really fun episode.
Also, I think everything that's going on right now with Black Lives Matter, just to hear his take on everything, it's worth a listen. Enjoy the episode. All right, first of all, I think it's important to note that Dahani and I...
Are we recording now?
We're recording. Oh, welcome to the Courageous Podcast, by the way.
Well, hello.
We're here on the Courageous Podcast with the one and only Dahani Jones. What's up, Dahani?
What's up? Tell them the truth, Berman. Since we got two Ryans, I got to call you Berman, or, you know...
That's fine.
How am I switching these names around?
I'm Berman. He's Thompson. No problem.
I don't know. I know you longer. So maybe I just call you Ryan. Or call you RB.
RB and RT.
I don't know a lot of Dahanis. Are you the Dahani? Like, if someone says Dahani, do you think the world knows?
Well, I think most of the world might know, but then there's also a Dahani Harrison out there, George Harrison's son. You know what's crazy? Here. The crazy part is, I don't know if it was this year or last year. Maybe it was last year. Maybe it was this year. I got a chance to talk to him on the phone. It's like your entire life, right? You have a name like Dahani, which most people don't have in America, right? If I were ever to run into or ever talk to someone of Indian descent, Asian Indian descent, they would know what Dahani or Dani meant, and people would know that name. For the most part, people wouldn't, you know, blink an eye at Dahani. But those that love the Beatles, right, who love George Harrison, would know Dahani Harrison. And so I always knew that there was this guy out there named Dahani that I'd never met before in my entire life. So, listen to this. Like I said, I don't know if it was this year or last year, because sometimes my years start to blur together. That's what happens when you play football. You know, things start to blur. I ran into a guy at a conference. It was actually at a stand together conference out in Palm Springs. And I started talking to him about some of the investments that he was making, some of the things that he was doing in bioscience and other areas. And I have some ideas of things that I think actually will make sense in the world, but I digress. I went to San Francisco, I met up with this guy, we're sitting in the lobby and we're having a cup of coffee. And all of a sudden he says to me, "Have you met Dahani Harrison?" the gentleman that I've been trying to meet my entire life that has my name, or I have his name, or he has my name, or we have each other's name, all of a sudden pops up in the middle of San Francisco with a guy that I just met maybe a couple weeks earlier. And then all of a sudden he gets him on the phone. And what's the first thing that Dahani Harrison says to me? I've been meaning to find a way to reach out to Dahani Jones. Look at that.
I love it. And actually, that's how Ryan Thompson, so Ryan Thompson and I are the only two Ryans in America.
There's only two.
Correct.
I get it. I get it. And what'd you say to each other? What's up, Rye?
I said, I've been meaning to find you my whole life. Finally.
Finally, Rye guy. Rye bread.
Here we are.
So, Dahani Jones. So, you've known Berman for a little while. Why don't you guys tell us how you know each other?
I was trying to figure out how long it is. How long we've known each other. Is it 8 or 9 years old?
I think for
me. Or was it 10?
I think it's 8 for me, 7 for you. Aren't you a year younger?
How old are you?
44.
Damn, you're old.
Oh, get out of here.
Are you really 44?
Yeah, you.
What's it like almost being half of 90?
Whoa.
Honestly, I go there every day. I'm like, am I already halfway through this?
You're 44?
Am I halfway through this? What are you, 40?
You're 44, serious?
Are you double 21 or 43? What are you?
No, I'm double 21.
Double 21. We're back to Vegas talk already?
Back to Vegas talk. But when's your birthday?
I'm a Pisces, March 2nd.
7th. Wait, I'm a Pisces too.
When's your birthday?
78.
78. February.
So you're 2 years older than me.
2 years older. Ish. So to answer Thompson, Ryan's...
We go, wait, maybe you were 9 and I was 7.
Yeah.
Maybe you were 10 and I was 8. Something like that.
Potomac Elementary, right?
Yeah, it's like, I don't think people realize, like, the history, the competition, the battle between brothers right here, and how long it's ultimately been. Yes, it was 30 years ago. Well, at least for you, it was almost 40 years ago.
By the way, I think you won the competition, Dahani.
It's all right. We all won in different ways. I'm on your podcast. You're not on mine.
I always joke, Ryan, this is like, Dahani was an all-star. I was a half star.
Okay, a quarter star.
Hey.
But we were both courageous. Look at that.
Amen,
you know,
man.
It takes a little time to find the word, but then ultimately it bubbles to the top in all that we do.
What was really cool, though, is, you know, life happens and we both leave the area. You know, I live in California now. You live in – are you in Michigan or Ohio?
No, I'm in Michigan. But actually, you moved to where I was born. So, you know, I let you go back to where I was before.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much for letting me do that.
No problem at all. I just want to make sure that you're comfortable. And I know Thompson is eventually going to move back to the beach. And both of you are, you know, it's okay. Hope you enjoy yourself.
All right, so in Maryland, I heard a story once, and I'll give up the site at the end, but this is a critical place to start. I heard a story when you were a rock star Churchill linebacker for our high school, that in the middle, you must have been a sophomore, and that your dad would call other players like at random times of the night. Remember, there's no cell phones at the time, so on the home line. And one running back in particular got a phone call that said, "From your dad, stop closing your eyes when you hit somebody. Keep your eyes open." Have you heard the story?
I've, as I was saying before, right? A lot of life has been such a blur, and so in the midst of those blurs, there are flashes of light of which you remember some of the aspects. Or stories that people have told you. And so I've heard from multiple sources in multiple times of my life about these phone calls that my dad would make to, you know, my fellow Bulldogs, right? And whether I don't even know if the calls were on Thursday night for a Friday game, or, you know, maybe a Monday before the week going to practice. But you know, my parents always had a way of including the rest of the team in our life, right? We were fortunate enough, you know the neighborhood we grew up in, and you know, my mother was a doctor, my dad was in the military, and you know, when you play football, all the team members are different. You know, people come from different areas. There are some that have a whole lot, and there's some people that have a whole, you know, nothing at all. And our house seemed to be this place where the players would end up, right? Before the game, having a meal, after the game, you know, having, you know, a get together, or during the week and just hanging out, or, you know, an extension of the family. And I think that's what was always taught to me as I got older. So yes, it doesn't surprise me that there are more stories out there about my dad calling somebody probably on a Wednesday night saying, you know, you better get ready for the game on Friday, or, you know, your number's going to get called, son, so you better be ready. Or, you know, if my son happens to slow down, you find a way to speed him up. You know, that's how the community, right? Or what my one of my good friends, Jun Yun, would say, it's like kinskin in the game, right? It's about the community coming together in order to support the team, so the team would be that much more successful.
Do you think that environment helped you after football too? I mean, you've been really successful coming out of the pro sports world. So how much did that influence you?
I think when you play sports, there's two things that happen. One is that, there's probably three. One is your family. Two is how you play the game and as it relates to your life. And three, the lens, right? How you recover from it, right? So one being the family and how your family ultimately brings you sort of this energy and joy on the field, right? There's something very dynamic, and there's something beautiful and something amazing about having your family members in the stadium, right? It doesn't matter what happens on the field, as long as everybody is still cheering, you're all ripping, ready to go. I would say then there's the team aspect, right? There's individual sports and team sports. And I think those that play those team sports can operate within those silos very well, but those that operate in those individual sports can operate in those silos very well. But those that play those team sports need the dynamic and functionality of the group. And depending upon what position you might play, you might lean more towards a little bit more of individuality than towards the team. Like as a middle linebacker, you have to be able to function on your own. As a quarterback, you need to be able to function on your own and be able to work with the team, right? That's not always the case in all positions. And then when you step away from the game, the lessons learned from the game definitely apply to a lot of aspects of your life, how you look at the field, how you experience the boardroom, how you look at work, and how you look at your training. All of those pieces sort of add up to the eventual life that you live. And so it definitely has an impact on my life. It always had an impact on my life. And I think even as I look at the world today, even if I don't notice it, even if I don't pay attention to it, it's still living. It still lives with me.
I mean, you're a makeup of a military man and a doctor. I mean, you've got discipline and intelligence. And so going
Wait, who depends on who you would ask that question. Because my mom's a doctor. I don't know if she would say that I was that intelligent. And my dad's military. And I don't know if he would say that I had that, or have that much discipline. I mean, you have to remember, you have to throw in Montessori education, right? And for those that understand Maria Montessori's best practices, it's always about asking questions. It's always about challenging authority. It's all about, you know, going on a learning safari. And so if you're disciplined, you don't ask questions. So, you know,
I expect
we would have to consult with some people along my life to see how much discipline I actually have, how much intelligence.
I would expect nothing less than that response to my comment, to be honest. But where I was going with this is, was there, going into Michigan, the prep work, the preparation, whether you did it for yourself or that was sort of instilled by your experiences from your parents and or all of the above. When you're going to Michigan, are you thinking, I'm going to go be the best football player I can be? Are they teaching you, you're not just going to play football, you're going to get an education? If you go back to that time, what was the thought process?
Well, you know, it's my senior year in high school, I hurt my back. And so I had surgery pretty much, I think it was either August timeframe, right? And so leading up to that year, coming off my junior season, I had a lot of potential scholarships and I was talking to a lot of different people. I mean, I haven't really talked about it in a long time, but I mean, I probably had scholarships like that. I wasn't that good, but I had sufficient amount of scholarships, yeah. Right? And then all of a sudden I had back surgery. I think it was August. I can't remember exactly what time frame. All I know is probably hot outside and it was DC. So it had to be an August time frame, right? The swamp gets hot. So I go and I have back surgery, you know, and the physician said that I probably wouldn't play football again. And I remember waking up out of my surgery. I think I actually stood up too quick. I almost passed out. And there was a moment in time where I didn't think that I may actually play any longer. And just as soon as I had that idea and that thought, I immediately dismissed it and tried to find the fastest way to get out of the hospital. And I immediately went to Cabin John Hill, which is basically a 45-degree angle. And I started walking up the hill. Then I started jogging up the hill. Then I started running up the hill. And, you know, that whole experience of going through sort of the trauma of having surgery and the fact that you needed to sort of rebuild yourself and then find your way into the University of Michigan, I basically convinced them to give me a scholarship, right? Because I had no scholarship, so I had to call them. I sent the videotapes. They basically sent the tight ends coach or the quarterback coach to come recruit me as a linebacker. They didn't really take it seriously, and it wasn't really until I took my visit and my mom, who I would say she was the hero in the story, walked into Lloyd Carr's office and said, you know, if you don't want to give my son a scholarship, I get it, because I can tell by virtue of the way that you recruited him, you're not really taking him seriously. Mama. Right. And Ryan, you know, my mom,
yeah.
My mom got a 1600 on the SATs. My mom was one of the first anesthesiologists, African-American in the military. Right. So my mom wasn't someone that you would mess with, so to speak. I mean, you might try her, and then all of a sudden all these eloquent SAT words might proliferate, you know, through her syntax or diction. You know, I wish I did as well as her on the SATs. I digress. She walked back out and, you know, I had a scholarship. And so, you know, going to the University of Michigan, don't forget the University of Michigan, was a bonus, but it was something that I wanted to happen, that I spent time working towards.
The fact that you've got that in you, I'm assuming you did those hills by yourself. Like, did you call anybody else? Were you like, hey, Jay Yerg?
Yeah, I called you a couple times. You never showed up.
I was 2 years older, man.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Big time. No, a lot. Some people did show up, and some people spent some time. But ultimately, you know, when you're trying to rebuild yourself, sometimes you have to go into yourself, and you have to spend time on your own, especially if you have a goal and a you know, an aspiration of which you wish to reach. And so, you know, I spent some time on the hill, and I spent a lot of time on my bike. I spent more time in the pool. And I remember specifically going back and talking to the doctor. And, you know, when I got my scholarship to the University of Michigan, I just showed him my scholarship. And I was like, you know, I think I proved you wrong.
How much of it is just showing up, getting out there, doing the work? Because I'm sure you've applied this lesson to other areas of your life after football.
I think everything is applied to life after football. I think everything is applied to the credit of those that are really spending time. I mean, nothing is accomplished without hard work, right? Nothing is accomplished without, you know, that sacrifice. I mean, I feel like a broken record, and I feel like I'm just sort of adding to the sort of cliche nature of hard work and to challenges in life, but it's true, right? Nothing beats hard work like hard work. Nothing allows you to reach your greatest heights but by climbing the mountain, right? So whether you have to spend time in the pool or on the side of a hill, or whether your mom has to be the one that's in the room and they say they're not going to give you a scholarship, and she says, you know, he's got a chip on his shoulder, and if you don't bring him into the school, he's going to beat you in the Rose Bowl. I mean, how ironic is all that, right? Then we ended up going to the Rose Bowl when I was at Michigan and beating Washington State, right? It's kind of a sick twist in this world of, okay, you're going to walk along this path. There are going to be some errant routes that you might trip on, and there might be some divergence, but ultimately, you know, the work that you're putting in and the time that you're spending and the community that you're surrounded by and the people that are in your corner are going to help you ultimately get to that destination.
Who was in your corner? Like, was there someone in Michigan?
You weren't, because you didn't even call me back.
Well, how can I call you back? Wait a minute. On what? Your landline?
No, there was a lot of people. You were in my corner, man. There's a lot of people that were in my corner. I think, you know, my teammates were in my corner. My family was in my corner. My coaches were in my corner. You know, we had a great community, you know, and other fathers and other leaders that were in my corner. I don't think that anybody makes it to anywhere without the subsequent support of those that are around them. Like, you know, I remember Fred Shepard, who was, you know, the coach of Churchill Bulldogs for such a long time, and him being an ardent supporter and still is, right? And then even when you get to college, or whether you get to pros, or even through the world of business, there's some supporters that are along the way that become like your uncles, right? And that become your mentors and become, you know, those that have done it before, ergo they've laid the groundwork, and now your job is to step into their shoes. And all I ask, and all that we all ask, is that they might move our foot over to the left or to the right to make sure that we stay on that right course.
I want to get to that thought on the importance of community, but like, give us like one. So you were drafted in the fourth round? What round were you drafted in?
Sixth round.
You and Tom Brady, same year?
Same year.
Who went first?
I went first. I wish I had gone second now.
Would you have changed positions as a quarterback if you went second?
I still can't throw the football.
So you get drafted in the sixth round. There's a great story. You wearing a bow tie to sign your first contract. But is that correct, by the way? Can you confirm that?
Yeah, I can confirm that.
What was like the – give us like one aha moment from your NFL experience.
The entire NFL experience? I mean, there were so many aha moments. I think that, you know, when I went to go sign my contract and I wore my suit into Ernie Accorsi's office, I think that was an aha moment or a defining moment, because, you know, you take it seriously like a business. And so why wouldn't you dress accordingly? Now, I would imagine some people might say something different now, but times have changed a little bit, but still business is business. And so you act as you're supposed to. Maybe that goes back to the discipline that maybe just a little bit of the discipline that I might have had before. There was another aha moment or defining moment in talking to Michael Strahan, and him always insisting upon, you know, shaking hands, looking someone in the eye, and saying please and saying thank you, and knowing that, you know, or to tell me that people won't forget you in the world of football, right? the world of sports, people have this keen sense, this memory, right? They remember the first player that they saw. They remember the big hit that they saw. They remember shaking the hands of somebody that they just met. They remember the autograph or standing in line for 2 or 3 hours at a time. They remember running into or bumping into someone on an airplane. You know, people remember all these different things. And so he always would remind me, people will remember you. And so even the first day that you walk onto the field or the last day that you step off it, make a good impression, because that is, you know, going back to the nature of community, that community will still travel along with you if you've done the right thing. Or that community may potentially be against you if you've done the wrong thing. So those were probably two aha moments. I mean, there was definitely the aha moment of going to the Super Bowl when I was on the Eagles, which was amazing. I think when I was on the Bengals and I got kicked out of my first two practices, that was definitely an aha moment. But that was more of my Montessori attitude and lack of discipline kicking in. But I think it was also my experience of playing the game for as long as I did and not willing to not willing for our organization not to be at our best, not under my elder statehood, right? And I think the third practice, I didn't get kicked out. I was made a captain. So I don't know. Maybe sometimes not being so disciplined, it works.
We're back to showing up, right? Like how you choose to show up, correct?
Right. I think it's how you choose to show up, how you choose to conduct yourself. And so the game of football, you know, from New York to Philly and Philly to, you know, Cincinnati, I think there was a lot of moments along the way. And as I continue to tell these stories, little ones start to unlock as I said before, it's been a little bit of a blur.
Well, you mentioned community multiple times, and, you know, we're sitting in this strange time with COVID and a time of reflection. People have spent a lot of time at home thinking, and then you have a lot of things going on in the community right now. I mean, what's your perception of what's happening here in America? And then, you know, how important is community? I think people have kind of lost a little bit of sight of that. And now, you know, being quarantined or coming back to the importance of that, and obviously, it's been important to your life.
Mm-hmm. It is the most challenging moment in all of our multi-generational lives. I would say from the elder, our elders who sit at 110, 115 years old somewhere around the world, to the child that was just born. None of us have ever been in this much of a pressure-filled situation, right?
Yeah.
And as much consciousness that we can muster, both of being old or young, or right where we sit in the middle at 42 and 44, right? Thompson, how old are you?
38.
I'm 38, right? You're the youngin'. So as we sit in the middle, we are, to your point, we're forced to pause. And I think the pause is the ultimate reckoning. And I say that word intentionally because everything that we've been doing has been moving so fast. Everywhere that we've been going is going so fast. And it's all of a sudden like we all slammed on the brakes of our bullet train, and everything in our life has begun to pile up behind us. And as we're all sort of heading towards this collision course and everything that's happening is colliding behind us, that pause gives us an ultimate opportunity to kind of stand up and really look around. And you know, COVID we've all known people that have gotten sick and that people have died, or friends that have gotten sick, or friends of friends, or family members. You know, we all know someone that's in some type of financial challenging position right now, whether they wanted to admit it or whether they didn't want to admit it. I mean, people are in really dire straits and becoming that much more vulnerable as it relates to it. And then the systemic racism and social injustice that we've seen through the deaths of so many African-American men and women. I mean, yes, we all know George Floyd's name, but there are Breonna Taylor, there are Ahmaud Arbery, there's so many names. So all of that coming together alongside with our personal journey through life and the pause and the reckoning that has happened as it relates to it puts us in a very introspective place in our life where we finally have to acknowledge some of the issues and not just acknowledge it. It's doing stuff about it and presenting a new way so that all of us can ultimately live a better life moving forward.
So Dahani, for the listeners, join me every Friday. I try to put on this action chat. It's an hour long conversation, and it's like anywhere from 50 to 100 people. And I had shared this quote in the one that you were in, and it was from founder or the CEO of the Jaguars, Shad Khan. And he said, racism in all its forms will kill. It kills people. It kills communities. It kills dreams. It kills hope. For many Americans, now is the moment. Never has that been clearer. I don't want to waste this moment. And then I turned to you and said, or asked, is this a moment or a movement? And do you remember what your answer was?
Tell me.
You go.
I mean, I'm pretty sure I said this is a moment to create a movement.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a moment for a movement.
This is a moment for a movement. And I don't, and this, that day when all the governors and all the mayors and all the politicians and all the people and all the business leaders and all the sports stars and actors and all of the, everybody in the world, whether it was here or in Japan or here in Saudi Arabia, here in Africa, when we all paused, right? That was the moment. We all were told, stay at home, spend time with your family, quarantine by yourself. That was the moment. And then we were able to watch all of this that happened around us. And that became the beginnings of this new beat of life where we started to pay attention a little bit more to the rhythm and realizing that some people's beats were a little bit different than the next. And in order for all of us to sort of create some syncopation, is that right? Is that the right term? Syncopation, rhythm, right? We have to work in lockstep. And that's what is moving and what's catalyzing us through multiple generations. And as you're seeing through the different protests, you have a 65-year-old man and you have a 5-year-old girl and you have fathers and sons, and you have daughters and grandmothers, you have white people and black people, you have brown people, you have Asian, you have every single person that's essentially sitting on the front line saying, like, I get our heartbeat is out of sync, right? So how can we put it back in the same tempo?
I kind of feel like, and I'm curious to hear what conversations you're having, because I want this to be a movement too. Like I'm worried, like, people think this period is going to pass, and then, you know, by the sixth wave of quarantine, it's going to go back to before. And so, you know, what I want is that this is the golden age of action. So what are you hearing, or what can we do to make sure this is a movement?
Well, I don't think it can go back to the way it was before, because there's too much evidence of the way that we want it to be now. I think it's always easy or always easier to glaze over what something or someone might have said But when you go back and you have visual, if you have auditory as well as visceral evidence of change, it's hard. It's hard to go back, right? Even if you were to look at it and say, you know, it takes 21 days to kick a habit, right? How long have we all been quarantined? I've been home since March 5th, okay? 100 and some odd days. If I haven't changed some of my bad habits, God help me, right? Our whole world, you know, we've changed. I said that in one of our other one of your other Zoom meetings, right? The world is going to be a lot different when we get out. Theoretically, a lot of us now we can go and do as we wish. So, what's going to be different about you? And I think that's also a part of the movement, right? I think that's also a part of the moment that created the movement, is that we ultimately acknowledge the fact that everything was going to be different. Why don't we become a little bit different too? And then now you have everybody taking pictures, you have everybody taking videos, you have people writing it down, you have people remembering. I mean, people might as well be taking those limitless pills because they're absorbing all the information in real time, and they will call you out. As much as I don't like some of the culture that we have now related to, you know, if you did one thing, we immediately cancel you. As much as that is a challenging place that we are in this world, some of that is we just remember so much. Now we have to figure out what we're going to do with the memories that we have. I mean, if you look at your phone right now, you probably have 10,000, 20,000 photos on it. You don't even remember half the photos that were there. But all of a sudden, we're forced to deal with that folder and cross-reference it against somebody else's folder. And that becomes the evidence of this moment, as I keep saying, that moves forward into the movement that's actually happening.
I think that, you know, part of it is, you know, people are looking maybe at the first, they're pausing, like you said, right? And they're looking at their life, they're looking at themselves, they're looking at what this experience is all about. And I think a lot of people are going to come out and be like, you know, I need to change some things, but change is hard. It's really hard for human beings, right? But it's constant. You know, you've done a lot of things, a lot of different things. You're an entrepreneur. You had a successful pro football career. When have you faced change, and how did you get through it? Are there tools that you use now to kind of mitigate, like, the internal conversation you have in your head when you're going through change?
I would say that change is hard for me, just like it's hard for so many other people, right? And I think that the tools that you use in order to get through change can sometimes evolve. And I'm not saying I have the perfect set of utensils in order to do so, because I think there's something about you that changes, and therefore your utensils sometimes have to, like the same spoon that you use as a child is not the spoon that you use as an adult, right? I mean, goodness, I mean, don't you love your sporks? So, you know what I mean?
The tool for change is spork.
The tool for change, yeah, is spork. But, I mean, things have changed for me a lot in different times of my life. I mean, you know, when you go from college to pro, and you go from pro from one team to the next team, that's a lot of change. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get out of football, and then you kind of still live with the legacy of football, but you're trying to move into this new world of television, and then in the world of television and into the world of business. And all throughout, you're evolving as a person. Your uncles or your support and your community are evolving, albeit some people might travel alongside with you. And so your mentality has to shift. And I remember one of my sports psychologists always talked about, you know, this regroup and refocus. You know, recognize, regroup, and refocus, he would always say. And I remember it still to this day, because, you know, when you made a play or you didn't make a play, you had to recognize what went right or what went wrong. Now you have to get your mind back in the game. So that's the regrouping, right? Making sure your body's all right, you know, arms good, hands good. Now this all happens within a quick second. And then you have to refocus. going on to the next play. Who do I need to talk to make sure that they are where they're supposed to be? What am I supposed to do in the next play? What's the tendency? What's the time? What's the score? What type of play needs to happen right now? What's my coach saying? So that recognize, regroup, and refocus, I think, can be applied, whether you're talking about sports and recognize, regroup, and refocus to the next team, or whether you're talking about sports to television, recognize, regroup, and refocus. Like, what did you recognize from the world of sports? How do you need to regroup in terms of where you are? How do you refocus in a new type of industry? The same thing can be relevant in business, whether it's a challenge small or a challenge that's large, starting a business or closing down a business, hiring someone or letting someone go, raising money or realizing that you need to reposition, right? So all these things are relevant in these change-like moments.
I think it works even well just in society. Like, in the spirit of, we could do this for an hour and maybe we'll bring it back, by the way, I'm serious about that. But, in terms of, it's a podcast about courage and let's, you have one son?
One son.
5 years old?
No, he's 7 now.
7, wow, man.
So like I said, you're about to be 45.
So let's for one second think about your seven. Let's think about your 7-year-old son, because he's gonna. Let's say he's now your age. Going through your recognize, regroup, refocus, and the changes that have to be made in order for this to be a movement. And we're talking about courage, right? So, what type of world do you want for him when he's 45?
I think, one could easily say you always want the world better, right? You always want more opportunities. You would like it to be a pleasant place that it doesn't shy away from a challenge, but ultimately provides new type of thinking. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that one could present the world. I know that we'll never live in a utopian society. There will always be some challenges and some discourse that will ultimately cause friction. But being able to have the freedoms to talk about opinions, to challenge authority in some areas, and to live a life of intellect, I think that's what we all ultimately want. Now, if you're talking specifically if I want my son to play football.
Yeah, you're going to call his teammates? You're going to call his teammates?
I'm going to call his teammates. That's a different story. So,
awesome.
But we'll see. There's a whole another line of thinking that says if we continue down the path of what we have been as a world, maybe things will not be better, right? And I don't ever take the pessimistic standpoint. I always look at optimism, right? So I'm wildly optimistic, but I'm wildly realistic about what's ultimately happening in this world. I mean, there's been a lot of things that have led up to the point of where we are now, that have arguably culminated in a moment. And there's a lot of movements that ultimately have to happen in order for the world to change. In a similar conversation with another friend, we were talking about the multiple layers that we have to peel back. And a lot of those layers of who we are as people have been created through years and years of pressure, right? Think about how long it takes to find a diamond, not manufacture a diamond, to find a diamond or to find an emerald or any other type of precious stone. It takes a while. And if you don't have the machinery and tool in order to be able to do so, then you're going to be searching for a long period of time. And I think we're now just starting to construct some of those very devices that are going to start to open us as people so that we can ultimately find those gems and so that we can ultimately create a majestic outcome for everybody that's a part of our world. And if we are not able to find some of those gems, then we're going to be searching for even that much longer, which can cause conflict. But ultimately, when we all present who we really are, we'll be better because of it.
Yeah, I like that. Here's to a life of intellect. That works for me. You know, I think that's maybe that's the point
but
of
that,
all this.
But that takes courage, though, right? That takes a lot of courage. Nobody. What's the quote? Nobody wants to get sunned. And for those who don't understand what sunned mean, is like no one wants to feel as though they don't know what they're talking about, right? No one wants someone to speak over them and act like their ideas or thoughts are better than somebody else. But there's a way to live a life of intellect where it's not only just represented in the words and the diction and the phrasing that you have, but the tone and the intention and the emotion behind it as well. And so there's a lot that's added to that. And there's a lot of responsibility behind it, which therefore ultimately is a lot of courage, because that means that you've gone inward in order to express yourself fluently externally.
Dude, I'll always be on your team, Donnie. I love that idea.
You're going to be on my team? You're going to answer my phone now?
Well, I'm pretty sure I always answered your phone call.
Thompson.
Just ring me. I'll get him.
Hey, here's to turning a moment into a movement. And let's keep talking, man. Keep doing your thing.
You too. I appreciate you guys.
Appreciate you.
See you, Dahani. Say hi to the other Dahani for us, will you?
All right.
Join us next week with rock and roller Emily Wolf. We chat about her journey in the music business, her first live performance, and how sobriety has changed her life. If you enjoyed the episode, please give us 5 stars, subscribe, and leave us a comment.